have to confess that I brought you here under false pretenses because I've got this title that's talking about smartphones and compilers, and you know, it's a little intimidating to be giving a talk about Scheme compilers with Guy Steele introducing you. So I'm going to talk about something completely different, at least for a while. I want to tell you about something called Bootstrap. What is Bootstrap? It's a middle school, after-school programming experience. It's taught completely by volunteers. It's got an extremely interesting demographic. Most of the students who participate in it are low income, large minority population. They write programs, they meet about 8 to 9 times after class, and they write some fairly interesting programs. They work collaboratively, so you get lots of smiling groups of students working with one another, helping one another, very nice outcomes. And when they graduate, they get a little diploma, which if you pay close attention, has a lambda on it. So you might just guess where this is going. Now that's the good news. The bad news is the reason they're smiling is not because they're in love with parentheses. The reason they're smiling is because of the kinds of programs that they can write. So I want to show you just one or two quick student programs that they've actually written. And Danny here is going to switch to his projector or to his computer. And here's one example of a program. And we will click run. And as you can see, there's a little basketball that's floating around. There's a basketball hoop that's floating around. And every time you actually score, you get some points. If you don't score, you miss points, and so on. That's one example of a program. There's another example of a program which is maybe a little closer to what you expect middle schoolers to be thinking about. And Danny? This one's a little different. Unfortunately, he doesn't get the girl. Okay, so we switch back. All right.
Score is an interesting thing to put.
Score is a very interesting word to use in that context. Okay, so a program like this, indeed any kind of program that you might write, has several components to it. There's some element of design, you've got to worry about the programming system you're going to run on, and of course you need to worry about the execution model. Now there's two kinds of design going on here. The way Bootstrap is organized, the students actually design the game themselves, as you can tell. And having designed the game, they then have to design the program that goes with it. And the program design part comes from our book, How to Design Programs. The game design is part of the Bootstrap curriculum. They put these two designs together and come up with what they want to write. The programming system is kind of a no-brainer, to me at least. Now, I do realize that I'm in a Lisp community where I believe there's still a few people who live up in the hills in a shack with a shotgun and canned food protecting the last running Lisp machines. So just for your information, that's Dr. Scheme. Okay? Don't be afraid. It's close enough. All right. But what I really want to talk about in this talk is not these two things, interesting as they are and would easily warrant at least a talk in their own right, but rather the program execution model. Now, it's always helpful to put things in a bit of a historical perspective. And in a Lisp conference, maybe the most appropriate historical perspective is to talk about a different programming language, namely Pascal. Now, there's a great deal that one could say about Pascal. And the wonderful thing about the Lisp community is that it's taken the trouble to say almost every single one of those things. Jerry Sussman is here, so you all know this magnificent book, SICPI. And here's the fabulous foreword from SICPI by Alan Perlis, which you all read and probably read numerous times as I have. And that, of course, is a very carefully considered remark. You might have slightly more off-the-cuff remarks like this one by Brian Harvey, which I will let you read. I will just point out, you were talking about middle school students and scores. There's something about casual cooperation, single-sex dorms, so maybe this goes both ways. Maybe it doesn't end at age 14. So, anyway, the point is, this is the kind of thing that the Lisp community likes to say about Pascal. But I think this actually demonstrates the problem with the Lisp community, because it's obsessed with all these profound and maybe not even very important details about, you know, functions and inhibition and cooperation and blocks and pyramids, and it completely misses the really important stuff like syntax. Okay? So I know I'm about 30 years too late, but I think it's worth spending just a moment talking about Pascal syntax. Okay? Now there's two observations I want to make about Pascal syntax. The first observation is that it's hard to imagine a more verbose pair of parentheses. But the real thing I want to focus on is this really weird thing about the last parenthesis in your program, because it's followed not by a semicolon, but by a period. What is Pascal trying to say there? They're trying to make a very strong statement. Your program doesn't kind of sort of end. Your program ends. Okay? It's over. You really want to drive that home. Let's think about modern programs in comparison. Let's take a web application. Okay? We have the user, and the user sends a request over to the web server and says, maybe find me flights from Providence to Paris. This program undoubtedly runs on an extremely fast list program written by Orbitz, yes, who are sponsors, so we got a little commercial plug in there. ITA. Runs on a very fast list machine run by ITA, and no matter how fast it is, the point is it executes a computation and then terminates and returns a response to the user. Now, the user then looks at that response and sends another message, maybe they say the third outward flight out of the options that you gave me, and it's critical for that program to remember what choices it gave, even though it has supposedly terminated. It needs to remember these options, process that, give you another response, which also it needs to remember so that it can get another request and process that request. Okay? So even though this program supposedly keeps terminating, it never seems to actually end. So it's ending and yet not ending, which is the exact opposite of the Pascal world, right? It really isn't ending at all, but it keeps ending all the time. Okay, well, this isn't a peculiarity of the web. In fact, you'll notice that I'm about to erase all the labels but keep the picture exactly the same to talk about desktop applications, which also have essentially the same sort of structure where, you know, it's just that the stimuli are a little different. Maybe it's a keystroke, maybe it's a mouse movement, maybe it's a mouse click, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, because there are many kinds of stimuli on a desktop as opposed to on the web where there's just really one, the web request, you actually have lots of different little handlers, each of which is a little program that has to run and somehow remember what it's doing. And, of course, the same thing also happens on phones. And I know you're very happy because I finally said the word phone in this talk. You were worried if I was ever going to say that at all. Well, the same thing happens on a phone where the stimuli might be user's movement or user tilting the device and so on and so forth. Okay? Now, I've sort of glossed over an important detail on these slides, which is I keep saying okay in response. But in fact, the program can't just say okay. It's also got to remember what's going on, right? So, for example, it might start off by saying the user is located at the origin. After the user moves, the user is in a new location. But tilting has no effect on the user's location. But moving back might return the user back to the origin. So this phone application, like the web application, like the desktop application, needs to keep terminating and yet not terminating. Okay? So this is a structural problem that all these reactive programs have to meet. What makes this ugly, messy, sometimes complicated, is the fact that the APIs for writing these callbacks, without fail, have essentially the same type. They all return void. Now, it really doesn't matter which language you look at. You can look at Scheme. You can even look at Java, right? Nice modern programming language for writing these sorts of things. You might say, well, it's a type issue, right? So maybe Haskell or ML. Well, no, ML is exactly the same, except instead of void, they call it unit. Okay? You can look at the Haskell APIs, and they have a different four-letter word, which is IO paren paren, which is a very sophisticated way of saying void. Okay? So, no go. All these APIs have a common structural characteristic, which means it becomes the problem of the program, which of course means the programmer, to worry about keeping this information in a meaningful state. So there are lots of different techniques we use for passing this information around. So in some cases, we might use, you know, databases and memory and maybe a remote web service. On the web, we have even more options. You know, we use the database sometimes. We use hidden fields, which is actually a pretty intriguing thing to do because it's essentially saying to the user, it's your data, you want to remember it, it's your damn problem. Here, deal with it. Right? You might even use a... It's a word I dare not speak or even spell out in full in a Lisp conference because some of those guys with shotguns might be in the room, but you can figure out what I'm talking about. So these are all options, but they're all options that are trying to get around a structural problem in the first place. Okay? You can view them as solutions, but you can also view them as symptoms of a problem that we have. Okay. So why is this a bad thing? Well, there's matters of taste, certainly, but I think we can go beyond that at least a little bit. One problem is, remember I started my talk by showing you all these middle school students? When they're actually in school and not in an after-school activity, they're taking algebra classes. Okay? And they're learning about algebra, and they're learning how to write functions, but then when they show up in a programming curriculum, they're being told, these things are called functions, but they're really not functions at all. In fact, the functions that you've learned are pretty much useless because you can't do any of the fun stuff that you want to do, like kiss the girl. Okay? Well, there's a second reason. You all remember the famous epigram by Alan Perlis. You may not have liked it, but you remember it. And except this isn't true. None of these computations, which are supposedly functions, return any values. In other words, you have disappointed Alan Perlis. Shame on you. But the third reason, and the reason that I sort of really care about, is math education standards. Okay? There's lots of standards out there, and pretty much all of them agree on the fact that we need to get kids to understand geometry and algebra. In fact, there are studies that show that algebra is one of the best predictors of future success, of likelihood of making it as a professional, and so on. And we have all these efforts. We wait till they get to college, and then we start off by saying, oh my goodness, it's a tragedy, they can't do anything, and so we need these fancy introductory courses. Well, we tried that, and then we went to the high school level and said, maybe it's too late. High school, and turns out at high school they've already zoned out. So you really have to go to middle school or earlier before they start to get them before they've lost their interest in mathematics. Okay? And all these educators know this, but what do they do with functions? They graph them. Oh, that's so exciting. Maybe we can do something more with our functions. And there's a reason we should all care. Certainly those of you who live in the United States have seen all sorts of statistics like this about how little mathematics kids actually know. It's why half the people in your companies have last names even longer than mine, right? So you can view this as a problem, as many people do. You know, you can find no shortage of editorials that look like this. Or you can view it as an opportunity. And you know why I view it as an opportunity? Because, you know, there's the NCTM is the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, and they have this beautiful logo. It looks like an infinity, right? But if you look more closely at it, you realize it's really a person being embraced by a pair of parentheses. And that person is actually a lambda. It's a sign, my friends. It's a sign. Okay? So let's do something about this. What can we do? Let's go back to why this thing returns void. Why is it void? It's void because the operating system is essentially hostile to the program. The operating system says, I'm not part of you, I'm my own thing, and I just want to support all these programs running on top of me, so I don't want to know anything about your program. I'm not part of your application. Right? And in fact, there's lots of OS research that says maybe we can blur that line a little bit, but this is the fundamental reason. Okay? Well, but what they should be is not hostile. What they really mean to be is neutral, right? They want to be neutral. They want to be agnostic to what application is running on top of them. And they've made the classic mistake of confusing hostility with neutrality, right? Neutrality simply means that you have to be impartial, but you can cooperate with everyone instead of cooperating with no one. Right? And there's at least a few Project Swiss people in this room, so that's, you know, neutral but heavily armed, of course. We're back to the same theme in Lisp conferences, it sounds like. Okay? So, what is the consequence of having this observation? Well, I want to actually tease out that picture a little bit because I've made it look like there's only two participants, but there's actually three. There's a user, there's the operating system in the middle, and then there's the actual callback. And the operating system's job is to mediate between the world and the application program. So maybe we can make it actually do a little more mediating. So instead of having this program, this callback, return void, perhaps we can have the callback actually return some slightly useful information. Right? We will have the callback return something that I'm going to call the world. Okay? Now the world is just some information that the operating system receives, holds on to, and the next time it gets a request, it passes it back to the callback. So the callback is allowed to terminate, but gets a place where it can store some information. That's the world. Okay? Now, the operating system doesn't try to interpret what's in the world. It doesn't try to parse it. It doesn't try to do anything with it. It just holds on to it. That's all it does. And, of course, it does this every single time there's an interaction with the user. So let's focus in on this picture just a little bit, on this region. What I'm saying is that when the callback is invoked, the operating system gives it the current value of the world. The job of the callback is essentially to compute a new value of the world. Okay? Now, the OS might pass along some auxiliary information, like it might say, here's the keystroke, or here's the distance by which the user moved. And, of course, because there are many different kinds of stimuli in the world, it might have lots of different event-specific handlers that it invokes, and that's perfectly okay. But each of these event handlers is going to have the structural characteristic that it consumes and returns a world. Okay? So in the case of the telephone, for example, the world is simply a representation of where the user is. You remember those little bubbles that the program was trying to remember? Well, that's what it is, right? It's where is the user currently standing. And the function that deals with movement is very simple. It simply says add, right? Just take whatever distance you moved by and add it, and that's the new world, because that's the new location. Now, tilting, you recall, we said, has no impact on where the user is. So that's even simpler. Okay? But that's not void. It says the world hasn't changed. How do you say the world hasn't changed? You write essentially the identity function. Okay? Simple, right? It's incredibly simple, and that's part of the point. So what the operating system is giving the user, the program, is a slightly extended service. Instead of giving you the services it previously gave, it gives you one extra service, which is this box. That's all. It's an opaque box to the operating system. There's all sorts of operations that can operate on this box. For example, there's an on tick that says every time the clock ticks, you consume a world and return a new world. You might have, you know, an on click, an on key that takes some additional information about the clicks and keys. And you now have a model that's extensible to other devices. For example, on the phone, you might say on tilt and on move and so on. Okay? These are ways of dealing with input. You also have ways of dealing with output. So on redraw says every time there's a world, you give me a scene, which is another functional computation. Produce for me an image that corresponds to this world. So you can have output services like that. And of course, you can have other services like stop when. Look at the world and tell me whether to stop or not. Okay? It's a Boolean. Okay? The important thing is, notice the types. They all have an interesting type. They're all pure functions, which means an eighth grader is in a position to actually write them, and what the demo showed you is they actually do write them. Okay? Every one of the programs that Danny ran, and there's many, many more on his disk, are all using this API. They're pure functional programs. Okay? So going back to this picture, I want to just show you quickly how this all plays together. Let's say what I want to do, incredibly trivial, right? I have to fit this all in a PowerPoint slide. Let's just say I have this plane over here, and I want the plane to move across the screen. Okay? So couldn't be an easier computation than this. This is essentially the Hello World program for our courses. Okay? Our Hello World program is make a spaceship take off or make a plane fly across the screen. So you can do this in the first week or, depending on your students, even in the first class. So the program is very simple. We set up some constants for the size of the display. We say what the initial world is. What's the world? Well, it's the position, the x position of the plane, because that's the only thing that's changing. So that's the only thing we need to remember. So we start off at 0. Plane is an image. Doctor scheme, you can put images in your program source. Perfectly reasonable. What is the rendering function? Well, it takes a world, and it gives you back an image that represents where the plane is. Okay? So this is again functional, compositional, all the good stuff that you know coming in about algebra actually works. If you're learning algebra, as some of those kids are, it reinforces the idea that algebra is a good and useful thing. Because the algebra they're used to is boring as hell. Right? It's over numbers. They don't have very many interesting numbers. They have slightly more interesting data like lists, but they have much more interesting data like images. They know that images are fun, and algebra over images is a heck of a lot more interesting than algebra over numbers. And of course, once you've gotten them hooked, you can do algebra over all sorts of data types, even over functions. Okay? Well, what happens every time there's a time tick? Well, you just move the plane. What does that mean? You just move the x position. And finally, you have this function called Big Bang, right? Because the Big Bang creates a world. So Big Bang says, run the program. Whenever there's a tick, call increment time. Whenever you need to redraw, call render world. Okay? And that's the whole program. So these are the kinds of programs that students start by writing, but then, of course, you can start to scale up in complexity. You can either make the interaction more complex, or once you've gotten them hooked, you can make the mathematics more complex. Okay? You have the choice of going both ways, but the model is nice and simple and one that they can already use. So to get back to this picture, let me just elaborate what I've shown you in this last two, three slides. We have these callbacks that are world-to-world functions, but we might also have other functions that consume a world. Remember, it's the operating system's job to hold on to that world and pass it on. So you might have a function that takes a world and returns a scene. And the operating system then displays that scene, so the user sees it. The user might, in response to that, provide another stimulus. The world hasn't yet changed, so the OS still provides the same world again to the next callback, right? Till the callback provides a new world. Okay? That's a service of the operating system. It's okay for us to demand a little more from our operating systems, okay? We want a slightly richer API. Might as well demand a little more. But there might also be more interesting and complex things going on here. For example, the operating system might also say, hey, I want to run this other function that takes a world and returns a bool. Well, remember, it's the same world, and that boolean is going to tell you whether to continue execution or not. And if that boolean comes back as false, the next time the user sends a stimulus, it says, sorry, the program's already terminated. But notice, it's the same world. There's no reason those things have to be done in the order that I wrote them over there. They could be done in the other order, and nobody would be the wiser for it. Nobody would notice. By writing programs in this style, we are opening ourselves up to being able to run things more concurrently. In fact, those could even run perfectly in parallel, and nobody would be the wiser for it. Okay? So by writing things this way, we're giving ourselves opportunities to do more interesting things. We're leaving it to the operating system, and I'll show you another instance of this in a moment. Okay. So, that's our model, and now, the reason you're really here, right, is you wanted to hear talk about scheme compilers on cell phones. Fine, I'll talk about scheme on cell phones. Okay? Here's what this talk is not about. Here's what Mobi is not. It's not a scheme compiler on a cell phone. All right? Anyone in this room could write a better scheme compiler on a cell phone than I can. So that's not even worth talking about. Okay? What it is a compiler from functional scheme plus world that runs on cell phones. Okay? In particular, we target the Android platform. We actually started by targeting J2ME. J2ME is actually a little bit weak right now, so we switched to targeting the Android. So we have partial support for J2ME, very good native support for Android, and you know the rest of it is a simple matter of programming. So you know, sure, do whatever you want. Okay? That's what it started out being. It's since evolved. It's a little more than just scheme plus world. As you may have guessed from the slides that I've shown you already, scheme plus world plus GPS sensing plus tilt sensing plus there's what we call GUI world, which is the ability to do not just images but graphical user interfaces also in this very pure functional manner. Right? You write down a description of what the interface looks like. That's a static description. It's functional. All of the pieces in there are also world-to-world functions. Everything's a function. Everything's compositional. And you can write, you know, you got buttons, you've got sliders, you've got drop-downs, you've got whatever. There's a bunch of other things like that, all the usual GUI stuff. Okay? All of those are in there as well. Plus, we now have some support for rudimentary web services. Okay? All these things are actually running. They actually do run on this phone. The baseline for Mobi is that we want all these student programs to run without change, right? So we want a student to be able to write this program, get it working on their desktop, press a button, and it runs on the phone, which means they can show it off to their parents. They can show their parents, in particular, can show it off to other parents, right? That's what this is really all about, right? I confess there's a slight bit of legalese there. The legalese, I might as well be completely honest here, is that the world that the students use in 8th grade is a little simpler than the world that I've shown you. And so that simpler version doesn't yet compile. That's, you know, that was the target date is after the Lisp conference. Okay, so we've been gearing up for this talk. At the moment, in fact, Danny is going to code it up on the way home, I believe, on the train. So, okay. Okay, that's the baseline. Now I want to give you a quick feel for some of the applications that we've written using this program. So first I'll start with a very, very simple game. Okay, we'll call it Running Out of Time for lack of a better title. And Running Out of Time looks like this. There's a screen, there's a red ball, and there's a blue ball. The red ball is the target, the blue ball is you, the player, and your job is to chase the target. Okay? Well, how hard is that? You move the blue ball around, except the blue ball keeps shrinking over time, which means if you don't get to the target in time, you lose the game. Okay? So it's a very simple game. And just to prove to you that I'm not fibbing, that it actually does run on the phone, okay, we're going to show you a little video clip of a thing running on the phone.
Tilt it to
him. Aha. Right? And, okay, back to my screen. So, the point I want to make is it really does run on the phone, and as Dan very neatly intuited and is going to tell you, the way you move the thing around is purely by tilt. Okay? Well, let's look at some code. Right? Width and height, so we can get ourselves a little drawing canvas. I'm going to define a structure for velocity, because that's different from position, right? We don't want to reuse the same structure. And finally, the target is at some position, right? Some randomly chosen position. I'm going to give you a slightly simplified version of what Danny showed you, okay? So the target's at some particular position. A world, in this case, actually let me pull that back. What is changing from frame to frame? Well, the target's in the same place, but what's changing is the position of your ball, the velocity of the ball, or, you know, really which direction it's heading at, right? What's that vector? And finally, what's its radius? Those are the three things that are changing, right? So those are the three things that are changing. Position, radius, and velocity. So the initial world is some initial values for all of these things, and in particular the velocity is zero because you haven't started tilting, so it's stationary, right? And it's just going to keep shrinking if you don't do anything. When does the game end? Well, the game ends either when the radius becomes too small or the two collide, okay? Collide is a simple function. Everyone knows how to write it. So there's two kinds of things that happen. There is a tilt and there's the passage of time. And I know to show you those two functions. So the passage of time, which I'll call tick, is a world-to-world function. It says, wherever I was starting out, I'm going to make a new world, right, where I add the velocity to the position, that's the new location. The ball is shrinking a little bit, right, the radius is a little bit smaller, and the velocity itself hasn't changed because the passage of time doesn't change the velocity, only tilting does. Okay? Makes perfect sense. I also need to show you tilt, which you can guess is almost the dual of this. The position doesn't change, the radius doesn't change, but the velocity does, and there's a little bit of, you know, squirrely detail about the API. There's two different kinds of APIs on the Android for tilt, blah, blah, blah. Okay? So you get some azimuth, pitch, and roll, and in this case, you just do this, and that takes the tilt into account. Okay? And finally, I need to bundle all this together, but before I do, let me just point out that there's a slightly different way of writing the tilt function. Okay? And it's going to look awfully familiar to some of you common Lispers, right? You're going to say, oh boy, this is an awful lot of work, right? All these fields stay unchanged except one. Why do I have to say all this all over again? Well, you don't. You can use something that we call update, right? So update world velocity says, leave everything the same except the last field, the well field, and the well field is now going to be that same expression. Note what this is not. This is not mutation. This is functional update. Update is something you can test at the REPL. Okay? You can go to the REPL, type this expression, and you will get a new value back, not something hidden happening behind the scenes, which means students can play with it, students can test it. Okay? Who knows whether a world is needed more once again or not? The operating system. This is a hint to the operating system that I would like to make a world whose well field is now this expression. If the operating system doesn't need that old world any longer, you get the hint. Okay? We give a hint to the operating system and let it do its job. So we're really imposing a lot more on the operating system, right? Which is good. Let them do some work. They haven't done work for a long time. Okay. Finally, I need to put all these pieces together, and it's very simple. I make myself 1 over 20 says update 20 times a second, and I start with the initial world. Every time I redraw, I haven't shown you the render function, but you can guess. It's completely trivial, right? Draw two circles. What could be easier than that? Every time there's a tick, run tick. Every time there's a tilt, run tilt. And stop when game ends. And we're done. That's the code. Okay? Again, pure functions, these are ways of getting students to actually explore algebra. They have to understand Cartesian coordinates to do this, but they now have a reason to want to understand Cartesian coordinates, which they often lack. Okay? Now, of course, I'm saying that this is all for, like, you know, high school students or middle school students, but we also use this to write programs that we want ourselves. So here's a quick program that I want that we've just written in this past week. Now, I keep saying this past week because this really has been, this is very much work in progress. Let me ask you a question. How many times have you ever put an envelope in your bag, walked to work, gotten to work, opened up your bag, and found the envelope and said, oh shoot, I went right past the post office and forgot to mail this. Okay, if Jerry Sussman has, that's good enough. Okay? How many times have you been past a store and said, oh, I forgot to pick up X? Okay, well, that's what we have computers for. And Dan apparently forgets everything. Perfect, okay? So, this is why we have computers, right?
I can't open my bag right now.
Okay, excellent. So, here we go. Here's a Google map, okay? Some of you may know Google has something called My Maps. In My Maps, you can set up your, you can create a custom map with custom, you know, waypoints along the map. So Danny's created here the set of stores that he shops in Worcester. One of them is Twins Oriental Market, which, like all fine Oriental markets, has a beautiful strip mall interface, which tells you it's a good store, right? And separately, he's got a shopping list that tells him maybe, you know, pick up rice noodles at Twins Oriental Market. So, here's a Google map, and he's created this. Now, the program says, I'm going to go to this URL. I'm going to get, you know, XML, right, complicated parentheses. I'm going to turn it into simple parentheses. Once I turn it into simple parentheses, I can parse it. And once I parse it, I now have a representation of all the stores. In particular, I know all the locations of the stores. Similarly, I can get all items. I can define it inline, or I can get that from a web service as well. You can put your shopping list online, read the shopping list off of the web, and so you have a shopping list that tells you what items you need to pick up from what stores. Okay? Now the Big Bang is going to say, every time I change the location, run, every time I move, run render, every time I change location, do update lock. Now, I've chosen, there's many ways of writing this program. I've chosen one, and it's actually a little unusual, but I just want to illustrate that you could write it this way, which is that on location change does essentially nothing. Okay? The world is, where am I? And on location change simply says, I'm now at a new location. That's all it does. So in fact, all the interesting work is going to happen in render. You could choose to structure this program differently. And by the way, I might point out, it's interesting when you have, at least in a teaching environment, to be able to point off the trade-offs between different structurings. Okay? Some are going to lead to much more efficient programs than others, and it's worth talking about that. So what does render do? Well, it generates a description of what I need to buy. What is the description? Well, it's going to get all the matching items nearby. Nearby where? W. What is W? It's where I am. So tell me all the items that I need to pick up near where I am, and turn that into a string. And what is matching items? Well, now we're back into SICKBEE world, right? Now it's trivial, right? You go look up all the places that are near where I am for some notion of nearness, take all the matching items from those, okay? Those of you who are like, you know, Maven functional programmers will write this as a map and filter or a fold, and you'd be done in like 2 lines of code. The students write about 7 to 8 lines of code, but it's the same code, okay? And that's the whole program. And that program actually runs on our cell phones. I'll tell you one last application that we've been using, and I call this homeward bound. I'm not going to bother showing you the code because at this point the code is trivial, right? This is an actual problem that we have, which is that my co-author, Kathy Fisler, works in Worcester and drives home to Providence. And every day before leaving would send me emails saying, I'm leaving my office now. Well, why do you bother sending email in this day and age? So, in fact, you would rather have a program that you turn on that says, I'm leaving the office now. But there's a problem, which is you might forget to turn on the program when you sit in the car. And you might turn on the program only when you get, you know, a mile away from the parking lot, at which point you don't want it to say, I'm still in the parking lot. You'd like it to tell you where you are. So this program lets you explore. So the point is, once you have this infrastructure, you can start to explore different notions of geometry and location once the infrastructure is in place. So the update infrastructure is exactly the same, but in this case, I can explore what it means to be a place. You ask people about places, and there's this mental model that people have that place, one place is different from the other. Worcester is clearly different from Boston. But in fact, places might overlap. Places might even be contained. So the WPI parking lot is in Worcester, but Worcester is not in the WPI parking lot. There's clearly a containment relationship there. So this now lets us write programs that explore this idea of shapes, containment, overlap, disjointness, and you can apply different policies to these things. So again, using a MyMaps interface, you can have a program, and these are screenshots, real screenshots, that says, I'm at 908 and I'm leaving the WPI parking lot. Or you might have turned the program on a little later, which means it doesn't say WPI parking lot, but it says Worcester, which means now Worcester minus the WPI parking lot. Or you might simply have forgotten to turn it on until you were halfway along on the highway, and then you simply get a message that says unknown, but it gives you a GPS coordinate, and if you click on that, bang, there you go. There's your map telling you where the person is. Okay? Again, this is a program that I find useful. My wife and I use it on a daily basis, and it's, again, about 15 lines of code. I've shown you almost all of the code on screen during this talk. Now, I think that's a very powerful idea, because one of the, you know, people are always obsessed with introductory curricula. Should we do Scheme? No, MIT says we should do Python, so obviously we should do Python. Oh, maybe we should do Common Lisp. But I think that's missing the point. We're not thinking enough about the computational models in which our students live and in which we operate. We're failing to do that. Okay? And the computational model has impact on everything else, and I've shown you what impact it might have on the kinds of programs you can write. I'm teaching the introductory course in the fall at Brown, and in the fall, we're going to be writing programs on cell phones because I believe that a student is going to be most motivated if the programs they write in class are at least comparable, maybe even better, to the programs they buy on the App Store. That's computer science for them, and that's where we need to be. Okay? So I want to start wrapping up this talk because I'm starting to run out of time. And you knew there was going to be a slide that had this text on it. Okay? So let me give you a little bit of perspective. I've already shown you, I've alluded during this talk to things we could be doing. We could be using this infrastructure for parallelism and concurrency because we are saying By writing in a more functional style, we leave it to the operating system to do smart things. People have spent too long writing in a stupid style that inhibits things from being done, and then we've spent millions and billions of dollars, you know, to Fortran compiler writers to try to get back all this parallelism that we went and lost. Okay? Maybe we can do something smarter. Okay. I said Fortran, that was just to get applause, right? Okay. I've said Pascal, I've said Fortran, I think I've hit all the bugbears here. Okay. I've also alluded to how we can do in-place updates. So if you're wondering, well, in-place updates are really important, we can. But in-place updates should be viewed as an optimization. If nobody else can tell, then you can't tell whether it was an update or not. And that's the right way to think about it. It's a slogan that my colleague John Gennady likes to use in his work, which is safe at any speed. You want to get it safe and then make it faster. Okay? That should work. That's John's slogan. There are other issues that I haven't talked about. I've only talked about world. But in fact, there's also a whole parallel development in PLT scheme called the universe for distributed computing, which takes the whole idea and lifts it up. So now you have lots of worlds. Worlds communicate with each other by message passing. And again, in a functional style, you can imagine, in fact, it would be a good homework exercise for you to go back home and sit down and think about what the universe looks like based on the design that I've already outlined to you. Think about what it would mean to lift it to multiple machines that are either talking to a centralized server or even talking peer-to-peer. Okay? There's a subtle flaw in the design of world that I haven't covered, but we run into in our programs, which is that world programs, as I've described them, are more machines. We really do need mealy machines as well. If that means something to you, yes, it's a problem. We need to explore it. If it doesn't mean anything to you, don't worry. It's a problem, and we'll explore it. Okay? All right. So, I do want to come back and say something about programming languages, though. I've just said it doesn't really matter. Maybe, you know, MIT did the right thing switching to Python, right? I mean, it must be. Jerry clearly agrees with it, so it must be a good thing. But maybe languages do matter. And I think something very interesting happened in the past decade. When I started graduate school, everybody said, you're crazy to go into programming languages. There's only one language that matters, and that's C++. And you know what? It was true. At the time, it was essentially true. It was hopeless to try to get to break that stranglehold. The thing that broke that stranglehold is the web. Because on the web, you could write in whatever the heck you want. I like to say... You know, the fine folks at Sun tried to spoil that beautiful little image by saying, oh, we want to have this additional language on the client, and it's going to have security and all this other stuff. And, of course, you know, it was successful in all sorts of things. It utterly failed at the thing it started out doing. Okay, so we got that. We kicked that threat back. But then something else showed up, which is, you know, Flash and ActionScript, and that won. But its victory made possible all sorts of other things that led to the rise of JavaScript. And so already we've got all these languages just on the client. Plus, we've got the server side, which has like a whole plethora of languages. And, of course, I'm not limiting myself to cell phones, right? Cell phones are just the starting point. I'd like to be able to write code that runs on an Arduino, which means I have to learn processing. And then maybe I want to make it work on a Lego Mindstorm robot, which means I have to learn a whole family of other languages. And by the way, Java isn't actually dead as a client-side language. It got reborn as something called J2ME. And I still haven't talked about the language on the most dominant smartphone platform, which is, God help us all, Objective-C. Okay? You're not going to have much luck trying to get a student to learn every single one of these programming languages to be able to write programs on the platforms that they care about, because they care about all the platforms that these things run on. Furthermore, you will have no luck even if you teach them languages, because every time you switch from one to the other, the whole programming model changes. Okay? It's not just about a syntax. It's not just about a set of library names. The model changes. One thing is pulling. One thing is pushing. One thing does this. One thing does that. And they're all squirrely in their own way. Okay? So maybe it is meaningful to try to go back to a nice, central, clean point of design. But Remember, it's about more than the language. You have to give them the whole triumvirate. There's got to be a programming system, there's got to be a design methodology, and you have to worry about the program's execution model. And what I'm trying to really sell you on is a uniform execution model, and why do I think this one will work? I think this one will work because it's not complicated. It's not fussy. It's a small veneer over what the operating system already provides. If you try to build a complicated veneer, it's going to work really amazingly on one platform and really suckily on another one. But if you make a small veneer over the operating system, you have a chance of making it work on all platforms, especially because this is almost what the platforms give you, right? The platforms are almost there. They snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Well, we can take it back. Okay? So that's really my takeaway message, and I would invite you to join us. If you feel like coding, you can help us port Mobi to more platforms. If you don't feel like coding, well, you're all working professionals, and surely at some point you have wished that you could produce smiling students that are gleaming with a pair of parentheses, so you can join Bootstrap and teach as a volunteer. I'd be happy to tell you how to do that. And finally, I want to thank the people who made this talk happen, but also the broader project. Emmanuel Schanzer is really the genius behind Bootstrap. Matthias is the guy who leads this whole effort and, you know, led the design of World and Universe, and of course the rest of the Dr. Scheme team. So, that's the end of my talk. I'd love to take questions. There's plenty of time for questions, so give me your worst. Sir.
How do boys and girls behave differently in program?
We don't know nearly enough about that. Part of what's going on, part of the reason the question is, how do boys and girls behave differently in this program? It's an excellent question because there are all sorts of demographic studies about this, about these differences. The reason it's a little hard to say much about what's happening in our case is because it is an after-school program. So it is, by definition, somewhat a volunteer activity. It's somewhat more of a, it's not a classroom, right? So A, I don't think we have enough data to really make generalizations, but B, even if we could, it would be hard to make significant generalizations because it's not the same as what might happen in a classroom. Okay? But we've had only 300. I think in a few years we'll be in a much better position to make meaningful statements about that. What I think I'm more interested in is this question of where, if you're concerned about the fact that we don't seem to be getting minorities or women into computer science programs, if that's a concern, you should ask, where should we be trying to tackle that concern? In college, it's too late. They've already chosen. So we went to the high school level and we worked on TEAT scheme for a decade. And you know, the honest truth is, they've already chosen by that point too. We look at our high school teachers, and their demographic doesn't look awfully different from our demographic. And if you look at the literature, you realize that students are starting to select themselves out of STEM disciplines, science, technology, engineering, mathematics disciplines, really starting 6th, 7th, 8th grade. So even high school is too late. So we really have to push back earlier and get them before their curricula and their teachers and everything else have turned them off from all this wonderful stuff. Okay? So I want to bring everybody in, and once we get enough of them in the room, then we can talk about what's going on, and I hope in a few years we'll have a much better answer to the question of how do they react. My guess, conjecture, is that we still have these problems because we've only been on desktops. So ultimately, the picture is still one of, you know, what I call PSAM, people staring at monitors, right? There's still people sitting at keyboards staring at monitors. They're not going outdoors. They're not doing things with their devices out in the great wide world. But once we give them that, we might have a different story. Okay? But ultimately, because it's all still sort of after school and fun, I'm not sure that we have meaningful answers yet. Okay? I hope in a few years I'll give you a better answer. Back there, sir.
Have you tried to work this into the school system?
Ah, excellent question. Not yet. We are starting to. Part of the reason we run this as an after-school program is because it's much easier to experiment in an after-school program. The difficulty with working things in the school system is Matthias and I actually have an essay that should be showing up in CACM anytime now. It's been accepted, so it'll show up in print at some point. And the title of the essay is Why Computer Science Doesn't Matter. Okay? Meant to be provocative. Why are we being provocative? Because at the school level, they don't care about computer science. If you go to a high school, middle school principal and say, you really need computer science, you know what their answer is?
What's computer science?
We already have it. Not even what's computer science. We already have it. It's our word processing class. Okay? So you have to first unteach them and then teach them, and it's a hopeless battle. Okay? In contrast, what they care about, for better or worse, is English scores and math scores, because that's what they're being evaluated on. If we can target the thing that we're being evaluated on, if we can show computer science as an aid to the thing that they care about, then we have a hope of having them listen. So the after-school strategy, I hate to say this in public because now I've given it away, but it's actually a stealth strategy. We have to get enough students in there, get them excited. Okay, by the way, we're actually doing computer science research too, but don't tell anyone that, right? Okay, so we have to get them in there, get enough demographic numbers to say, look, these kids are actually excited, they're doing good things, and then we might have a hope of having high school teachers and high school principals care. We are getting very positive feedback about the impact that Bootstrap has had on students' algebra excitement. The same teachers and parents are saying, before Bootstrap, my kids didn't care about algebra. Now they understand why it matters, and they're getting excited about their algebra class. I'm told, I haven't seen this report yet, I'm told that Harvard Business School had some students, sort of thing they do, right? They go out and do various activities. One of the things they did was go off and evaluate programs for Citizen Schools, which is the organization that runs Bootstrap and various other after-school programs. They interviewed students, and Bootstrap was the favorite of some, but not of others. Okay? But the students in Bootstrap were able to give much, much more sophisticated answers than anybody else about what functions were and why they mattered. And they said things like, I need to learn more math because I need to make my player be able to do the following thing. Okay? So we're working on that. I want to have enough numbers from this program to be able to make a case to those middle school teachers and principals, because you get one shot, right? You get the eyeballs once, you get the ear once. When I get that one shot, I want to be able to make the best possible case. Okay? So, but I'm actually talking to some people in Providence. I don't know if it'll happen this year. It'll happen soon enough. Okay. Next. You've had your hand up. Yeah.
How does your program compare to the squeak-based programs like eToys and Scratch and all those OLPC things?
Okay, I wish you hadn't said OLPC because you'll see me spewing with rage. So I'll just pretend you didn't say that. Okay, Squeak doesn't have this computational model at all. Okay, so Squeak is extremely elegant, but it does nothing to help students understand algebra. It fails at two things. Okay? It fails at what I call lateral transfer, which is transfer from computer science to other things inside the curriculum at the same time, like algebra. It fails at vertical transfer, which is once you're done with it and you've had a few weeks of entertainment, where do you go? Where does it scale up to? It doesn't scale up. It doesn't scale sideways, and it doesn't scale up. We scale sideways, we scale up. If you do a sixth grade Bootstrap, you can then do eighth grade how to design programs, 10th grade how to design programs. As Guy very kindly said in his introduction, there are high schools that have gotten so far with how to design programs that they're actually teaching what is normally a second or third year college level class in high school with my textbook for programming languages. We have all this material available. You have to think about both lateral transfer and vertical transfer. We have both. I claim they have neither. Okay. Back. There was a hand up there, sir.
Try getting them really young.
Okay, that's a great question. Have we tried getting them really, really young? The very short answer is no, because I don't know how to. For better or worse, I actually have a day job. And my day job is teaching at Brown and working with students at Brown and doing research and studying computer security and all the other stuff that I do. And if I quit that, maybe I could do this. But the problem is we have this problem in PLT where all of us also have other day jobs. And nobody has sort of dropped down and said, this is the only thing we're going to do. Now, the middle school thing was also we said we don't really feel like we know how to get into middle schools. And Emmanuel said, I know how to do this with middle schools. There's this after school program and we can start at that level. Okay? So what we need is a way of getting into that space. You know, it's related to the question of how can we, you know, can we go to middle school teachers? Well, that's hard. And same way, getting to primary school teachers or students is hard. If we could find a lightweight way of doing it, like this after-school program, we'd love to try it out. To be completely honest, I have no idea how this curriculum would work because they don't have the algebraic sophistication to do very much. Okay? At that level, maybe the only thing they can do is squeak. I don't know. So it's a question that we're explicitly trying to not think about at some point. When we feel like we have a real handle on middle schools, then we can think about that question. But if anyone has suggestions about how we might be able to break into other territories, I'd love to hear about it. Let's try that side of the room. One. Yeah.
Well, just two suggestions. One would be hitting up charter schools, and the other one would be hitting up Catholic schools.
So there's two suggestions for charter schools and Catholic schools?
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to look at ways of getting around.
Perfectly reasonable, but let me just tell you one reason why we haven't gone those routes, which we could have in the past as well. I want this curriculum to work for everyone. And what you've seen here is the demographic that says 70% of these kids are actually on, this is how educators study whether these kids are economically disadvantaged or not. 70% of them are significantly economically disadvantaged. And there's always a danger of a curriculum that works really well at a school that either is or can be made to look like it's a fancy, separate experience and one that actually works with the masses. Right? I want to set ourselves this harder target, but you're certainly right that maybe for trying to explore new territory like elementary schools, maybe we could try schools like those.
Well, the other thing is in a lot of cities, charter schools really are public schools. But it's like they embarrass the other schools and the other schools try to...
That's completely true. And if you try to go to the average public school and say this worked at a charter school, you might just have them climbing up for precisely that reason. Yeah, so we're unfortunately not very good at the politics of schools, and there are political issues as well. But those are both very good suggestions, I think, well worth thinking about. Let's try, yeah, please. No. Okay, thank you. Question is, if we consider working with EXOs? No, I'd rather not touch an EXO for as long as I live. Okay, yes.
Lovely presentation. A technical question about this functional state transfer thing. Whenever I do this, I end up wanting to add values to my world over time, and so my program ends up having bugs because of parts of the world and positional parameters, and what I really want is a more expressive functional data structure.
Mm.
What do you think of Clojure's new functional maps, for example? Is that useful in this context?
So the question is, for example, as programs evolve, you want to be able to add more fields, and how can we use things like Clojure's functional maps to do it? And so the short version is absolutely, from your point of view, knock yourself out. Okay? From my point of view, too, I would love to have something like that, and adding something like that to PLT scheme wouldn't be hard. But there's the other side of it, which is you want to give them knowledge that translates to lots of environments. The whole design methodology we teach them, we explicitly teach them the thing in Scheme, and then at the college level we teach them the same thing again in Java, because we want to show them that this idea is much broader than just Scheme. It's not a Scheme course, it's not a Scheme idea, it's about designing programs, not about designing Scheme programs. So there's a tendency or a danger of trying to give them things that turn out to be quite complicated, and 10% of the students will immediately understand exactly what that's for and go nail something with it, which they couldn't otherwise. 20 to 30% will be, all right, okay, I can figure out the mechanics of this but not get the deep understanding. And some significant percentage, maybe 30 to 40%, well, I know that didn't add up to 100, that's okay, will just be completely confused and not know what this thing is. Right? For the kind of programs that the kids are writing, certainly, they don't need to worry about extensibility. If I wanted to write a complex application such as these map applications, I do worry about extensibility, and those are just two different realms. Okay? So that's why we don't explore it at that level, but it's certainly reasonable. As I said, the operating system is agnostic, right? You can put anything you want in there. You can put a Fibonacci heap if you want in there, and the operating system wouldn't care. Which means you can put one of these fancy list structures that grows and extends, and that would be perfectly okay too. That answer your question?
It did.
Okay, good.
Two more questions, maybe?
Oh, come on. I finished my talk early. All right, Will?
With your execution model, if the operating system were doing what you'd like for it to do, it seems like there's no reason why any of these hammers should have to be written in the same language. You could have that level of abstraction, it should provide a great deal of portability and interoperability.
I wish I had said that. Thank you. Yeah. No, and that's absolutely true. There's nothing to respond. That's an absolutely valid point. We just happen to be working in the scheme world. There is something to be said at a pedagogic level to saying keep the number of different languages and complexities down, but there's nothing that prevents this. If all operating systems did this, then everybody would be doing things this way. Right. Okay, two last questions. Our last question. Yeah. Okay, two. Yes.
Have you considered combining this with distance learning so you can get around the day job problem? I mean, if you were teaching somebody four or five time zones away,
yeah,
then you could route around your day job.
Don't tempt me. So the question is, could we do something like this by distance learning? Unfortunately, I haven't tried distance learning, and I don't entirely understand how it works. And I say this at sort of not at the shallow level. I completely understand how it works mechanically. I don't understand how it works as an educational device at a deeper level. My experience is, I'm a classroom teacher. That's what I am. And I don't quite know how to do this. And I'm afraid that part of the problem is the whole PLT culture is, we're all classroom teachers. We don't entirely know how to wrap our heads around this model. Okay? Now, we do put out all the material for free on the web, and that's a really important core value that I think we have. The software is available, the book's available, and the thing that warms the cockles of my heart as a student writing in and saying, I live out in some third world country, India or whatever, and says, I found this book and it's really great, and you know, SICPI does the same thing, and I think that's a good value. We've talked about being able to do things like videotapes and so on and put them on the web. The difficulty is that we have so many different users and they all work at a different pace. We have high schools that in 10th grade go much, much, much faster than many of our college users. Okay? And so trying to provide the educational material such that all these people can work, I don't know how to do it. So I really, it's one of those things where I wish we had people who knew how to do it. We don't. But if we could, it'd be great to do. Right? Okay. Yeah.
To do audio, I just watched a fifth grade girl get hooked on Scratch.
Yeah.
The idea was she could record voices for her character.
Yep. And we will in about a week.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. You've been a great audience.